Danny, remember, you got to break someone in for next year. I'm not letting you go. I'm putting a string on you, period. Okay, today, can I begin? Yeah, okay. Today is March 12, 2012, and I want to say hello to the students in front of me and to the many, many that are listening across the world. Today is a very important share. As I mentioned yesterday, it's a difficult share for me to give. You'll understand why later. But first, let me just go back to last week. Last week, we continued what is Das Torah, and we dealt with Rav Desla, Michtav Me'Eliyahu. And if you looked into that piece, which is a very sharp piece, Ruach HaKodesh, etc., and you look into the footnote, and you look into the Talmidim, and the question, and how they deal with the Rebbe, you can see that my interpretation is correct, and even some of the Talmidim felt a little bit uncomfortable and with that comment, and who would have listened to the Gedolim had they said go in Aliyah? And that's an unfair comment, because the truth is that many, many Jews would have listened and would have been a different state of Israel. I can tell you something right now, at today's date, and you'll look at this 43 years from now, and you'll say either I have insight or I'm a fool. It's very simple. 43 years we lived in a country where there was no democracy. One boy served in the army, one boy didn't serve in the army. It's like telling us that in the United States, one person pays taxes, one person doesn't pay taxes. Now all this is going to change. If the Gedolei Yisrael would come out and say the army, and quote the Gemara in Sota, quote the Rambam Hilchot Melachim, Ein lanu mitzvah yoteh gedola bezman hazeh, then building a tzvah haganah Yisrael, there's no greater milchemet mitzvah we've ever faced since the time of Hitler and Achashverosh and Paro. Here you have Bifneyam V'Eder at the UN, Achim Ajad Yamach Shmo V'Zichro, declares he wants to destroy Israel. No, will everyone listen to the Gedolim? Absolutely not. But once they declare it publicly, many will listen. Hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands. By not declaring it publicly, it's going to be a bitter struggle. But 43 years from now, you'll see that everyone serves in the army, everyone learns Torah, the problem has been totally resolved. But instead of having resolution in a happy way, it's going to be with difficulty, malediction, infighting, controversy, etc. 43 years from now, you tell me whether I'm right or wrong. And this is exactly, had the Belzer Rebbe, had the Gerer Rebbe. The Gerer Rebbe actually visited Israel many times, but they didn't come in Aliyah en masse. Had the Belzer, the Gerer, the Munkacha, had they come out and said, Jews, go in Aliyah, 100 would have listened, 1,000 would have listened, 10,000 would have listened, the total in Hitler's inferno would have been infinitely less. Okay. But anyway, it's very interesting, and I hope you looked at the Michtav Me'Eliyahu Bifnim and you saw my interpretation, and whether I'm correct or not, I leave it to you to comment on. Then we went into the Rav's famous drasha, Yitzchak, how is your granddaughter?
The operation was delayed till this morning.
Delayed till this morning. Okay, so everything should be good. Whatever Divrei Torah we say today should be a skut for Daniela. Then we spoke about Murray Rebbe's famous hesped for Reb Chaim Moshe Grzynski, and as a real agudist once said to me, Aaron, there was never a greater statement of agudist ideology in the United States or since 1919 than the Reb's hesped for Reb Chaim Moshe. And of course, it's a beautiful hesped, it's beautiful dashanut. Did the Rebbe change his mind? Absolutely. And you don't need Rakefet, although I recorded it, and it's no one has ever challenged what I've said on that recording. But nevertheless, when I can cite for Baron Lichtenstein, I am on much firmer ground than just Aaron Rakefet. And the Rebbe changed his mind. And of course, for people who believe in Das Torah and Rabbanim speak ex cathedra, it's very hard for them to comprehend that the Rav changed his mind. In my humble opinion, it was a gradual process. Rabbi Lichtenstein has echoed my thought. You can read about it in one of the Alonim of the Gush, of Alon Shvut, to their graduates, to their Bogrim. And Rabbi Aaron, too, says that the Rav became an activist because of World War II, and activism means you become a Mizrachiite, not an Agudist. Aguda was in favor of Shtatlanut, Mizrachi was in favor of activism. Now, when we go back to 1938 and everything I read about in the Suvi era, do you demonstrate, don't you demonstrate? So I just want to explain, I couldn't understand why Michael Miller was having such a difficult time understanding me. But it's not that those who didn't demonstrate, it's not that they said, let the Jews die. Chas v'chalila, they felt that by not demonstrating and using quiet diplomacy, you'll save more Jews than by demonstrating. And this is a delicate question. And Agudat Yisrael, Reb Chaim Moiser, and the leaders of Agudat Yisrael, shtatlanut. On the other hand, Hitler, the Mizrahi, the Zionist element, we have to confront them, we have to demonstrate, we have to act. And this was a machloket l'shem shemayim. I don't want you to walk away thinking that those people who said, don't demonstrate, that they felt that by not demonstrating, let the Jews die. Chas v'chalila. They felt, don't demonstrate, but quiet diplomacy. And this is a very delicate question. When quiet, when not, we'll come back to it later today. Now, there's no doubt in my mind, and I've said this many times, and I can prove it, and I have a footnote in my work on the Rav, where I cite the Boston Rebbetzin, where she also says how shaken up the Boston Rebbe was, her husband was, by 1943, when they went to see the President of the United States, and he spat in their face. Millions of Jews have been killed. Millions will be killed. And he refused to see the Rabbanim. And his own Jewish advisors told FDR, Shem Rishom Yerkam Yasein, a Jew. It's a Mishnah, with the Kohanim who wouldn't share the secrets. But Roosevelt was... Excuse me?
The Mishnah says Yarkivu.
Shem Rishom Yakivu, you're saying, okay, I stand corrected, Lashon Rabim, but on Roosevelt it would be on an individual, it's Yakiv. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Roosevelt was told by his Jewish advisors, they're a sickly weed, you don't pay any attention to them. And of course, this had a great impact on the Rav and on many others. I have to say about the Boston Rebbe, I can tell you this off the record, that in his old age, when he saw what Agudat Yisrael was capable of doing, and when he saw the exodus from Gush Katif, he told people privately, if he'd be younger, he'd pick up on the Agudat and Wetzet Gedolia Torah and make a very public stand. But he already was ill and old, and although he yelled and shouted, we all know that Agudat Yisrael trampled him and made the exodus, the tragedy, every rocket falling in on Israel today, Agudat Yisrael, the Gera Rebbe, has a share in it. And you may quote me, and it's an absolute, total fact. Okay. Now, this question of being an activist or not being an activist, this question of Das Torah, this question of how to relate, this question of how to act, a question of such dinei nefashot comes to the fore in the question of Russian Jewry. And I probably will have to devote the entire shiur to the question of Russian Jewry. Now, just briefly, and Yitzchak, do me a favor, convey to Michael what I said so he should understand what shtatlanut means, because he walked out of here like with the feeling, what are these Jews, murderers, Gedolei Yisrael, shtatlanut, not demonstration? But that was their thinking. The greatest achievement of the Jewish people since Churban Bayit has been the creation of the State of Israel and the creation of the Israeli Defense Forces. God watch over them. This is a miracle of miracles that Jews can create an army. Two Jews have three opinions. I need not tell you that, what it means a chain of command, what it means to salute someone. I mean, that a Jew can salute another Jew is a miracle that each time you see it, you have to make a shechiyanu, shechadosh baruch hu zikal tanu, lirot etzem. Okay, second only to the State of Israel is, of course, that we Jews, we simple little bus of a dumb, little kids like a kid named Aaron Rakefet and so many others, and Yitzchak Rubin sitting here, and so many others, we went and we saved Russian Jewry. Who could believe, you know what communism was, you know how powerful communism was, you know how Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, I quote him in the Rav, and I saw it in person, how he at Gitzitit, he trembled when he spoke about communism. He saw their power, he lived under communism. Anyone who lived under communism, and what we believe with Sputnik and Red or Dead, what went on in the United States in the 50s or the 60s, this was the most famous debatable topic. Every college, every university that debated Red or Dead, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb wrote a piece in the early issues of Tradition dealing with it halachically. Is if your choice is to be Red or Dead, what do you choose? And here, a bunch of housewives and children and schoolboys, to quote the KGB taunting Sharansky, we brought down the great, all-powerful Soviet Empire. And who would ever dream that today in Russia, Putin is drinking l'chaim with rabbanim with long beards and payas. And it's beyond comprehension. Who would ever dream that 1.5 million Russian Jews would wind up in the State of Israel, and there'd be tens of thousands of balei tshuva, that's without exaggeration, among Russian Jewry. Okay, so this is a miracle that we live, that we struggle with. Great blessing creates problems as well, that's part of life, but thank God we're alive to contend with it. Now, after the Holocaust, when I was growing up, no one spoke about it. Holocaust was reality. Most of my classmates in Salanta, in Talmudical Academy, were survivors. Even where they weren't survivors, these were kids whose parents ran away to America in the 30s. Most of my classmates' native language was Yiddish. Yiddish was the language they spoke with their mother, with their father. Holocaust was a reality. No one spoke about it. No one spoke about their struggles. No one spoke about what they went through. One of my closest friends was a person who today is a great Gaon, Rav Abba Braunspiegel. I don't recall Abba Braunspiegel ever talking about what he went through in the concentration camps, in the lager, the lack of food, the torture. Yeah, occasionally he spoke after World War II about the rabbis who came around to the camps, and Abba, who has a cynical streak in him, would describe some of the rabbanim. I don't want to repeat some of his descriptions. That's about the only time he ever opened up. And then by the 70s and the 80s, a floodgate began. People who had survived, people who had remade themselves, people who had recreated their lives, suddenly 30 years later, 40 years later, began to talk about, publish what had happened. Same thing with the epic saving of Russian Jewry. Books are starting to come out now. This is the second book I know of that's come out in the United States. I know in my humble work you have 4 chapters, I believe, which I thank the Mossad for allowing me to publish it. I happen to know that Mossad people, as you know, they came to see me here a few months ago, right before my mother died, to take some of my pictures. And I know that they're working on a major work, and they're going to be more works and more works and more memoirs. And there's CDs that have come out, DVDs that have come out, I should say. And Baruch Hashem, a lot is happening. Now, in order to this volume, let me just show it to you by Gal Beckerman, "When They Come For Us, We'll Be Gone." That's what the Russian Jews felt, that it was hopeless, they were struggling, they were being arrested, the epic struggle to save Soviet Jewry. It's a fabulous volume. There's one mistake in here that I caught, but I guess outside of my own little volume, I will never get any credit for the little good I've ever been able to do in the world. If you know Rosenblatt, I spoke about it last year, it's not important now, one volume came out, and I don't even pick it up, every word in it is false. But the part on Russian Jewry is very small in that volume, but they have the totally false. But here, they are good at Yisrael. They speak about are good at Yisrael. Ernie Hirsch, "I'm the person who got a good at Yisrael involved. Did I do good or did I do bad? I still don't know until today. But I'm the one that tied a good at Yisrael with Ernie Hirsch in London." In this book, if they have Ernie Hirsch contacting a good at Yisrael. All right, I can't win. That's part of life. Baruch Hashem. I did get a call from Ernie Hirsch to thank me what I wrote about him in my book. Okay, now, we're talking about 1987. And 1987, just a little bit background. Under Stalin, the Jews suffered tremendously. Particularly after World War II, he became paranoid that the Jews are an international organization, the Zionists are an international organization, and particularly if the Golda Meir becomes the ambassador to Moscow, to Russia, and Golda Meir, Rosh Hashanah, 1948, the word goes out that the Israeli ambassador is going to go to shul. There was one functioning synagogue on Achapova, on Prospect Achapova, on Achapova Street, and something like 40,000-50,000 Jews came out to the shul, stood in the courtyard before the shul, stood on the street, cheering and singing that Golda Meir, the first ambassador of the new state of Israel, has come to the shul. Stalin went ballistic, and they say that's when he started to think about exiling the Jews to Siberia. They haven't lost their connection. They haven't become good Soviets. They haven't become good communists. They still retain their concept of the Jewish people, which goes against everything the Soviet Union stood for. Citizens of the world, unite. The workers have to conquer the world. All nationalities have to be broken asunder, and we all have to become good communists. So Golda's presence sparked the Jews. Then, of course, there was the doctors' plot where Stalin arrested all the Jewish doctors. They're trying to poison Russians. They hate Russians. Then he had the plan to exile all the Jews to Siberia. And lo and behold, before he can do it, he drops dead. And as I've told you more than once, had the Jewish doctors not been in jail, Stalin would have lived a little longer. That's an absolute fact, and a book has been written about it. I cite it, I believe, in Washington, Rabinovitz's book. Okay. Under Khrushchev, there was a thaw, and the first rabbinical delegation is allowed to visit the Soviet Union, headed up by Rabbi David Hollander, Rabbi Heschel Schachter, senior, not the Rebbe, who was a little kid at the time, but Rabbi Heschel Schachter, who was a prominent rabbi. There were other rabbanim with them, and they went the length and breadth where the Soviets would allow them to go and spoke in the synagogues. And there was a little bit of revival. Of course, Khrushchev, then Brezhnev, and the Six-Day War. And now the whole world is waking up because the Soviet Jew is waking up. The Six-Day War had a tremendous impact on him. I've told you more than once how I began, and I have this in Washington as well, I believe. I hope I have it, how I began every lecture in the army. When I come home after this lecture, I'm going to kiss the mezuzah, I'm going to kiss my wife, and I'm going to kiss the television screen. And of course, 200 soldiers would jump forward. Suddenly, they forget my American accent, and they're captivated by what I've said. Everyone understands why you want to kiss a mezuzah. Everyone understands why you want to kiss your wife. But why do you want to kiss the television screen? And of course, that would serve as the springboard of my lecture. that on this television screen, the Russian Jews saw the Israelis preparing to be decimated, annihilated by the Arab hordes in 67. The Russian commentators were laughing and dancing with joy that soon all these Jews will be wiped out. And the Russian Jews saw their cousins, saw their brothers, saw their sisters, saw their people, saw Am Yisrael, and they woke up and they started yelling and shouting. They want to leave. They want to be reunited. They want to be repatriated. I can't go into all the details. It'll take hours. According to Russian law, you could claim repatriation. Otherwise, you were considered a traitor for wanting to leave the Soviet Socialist Republic, the beautiful Garden of Eden that they created. Okay, if the Soviet Jews woke up, Allah had come and become the American Jews, and Meir Kahana, never again, as I mentioned to you, someone named Yaakov Birnbaum has tremendous skliut. He organized the SSSJ, went to the dormitories of Columbia University and Yeshiva College and asked the Jewish boys to come out and demonstrate, and all of us had a guilty conscience because all of us remember we did nothing. It's our parents, our grandparents did nothing during World War II. We worshiped the ground Hitler walked on. The Reform rabbis led the Jewish community in the United States, and they abetted in the murder of killing of millions of Jews because the State Department told them to keep their mouths shut, and they didn't yell, and they didn't shout, and they didn't scream. And as you all know, as Netanyahu, who said it beautifully just last week, they pleaded, bomb the tracks to Auschwitz, and America told us to go fly a kite. And because of the United States, another million Jews were killed who could have been saved. Okay. Now, the story of the activism always was debated. Are you activist or shtatlanut? And each one had their viewpoint. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, and no one suffered more than Lubavitch Hasidim. Many Lubavitcher Rabbanim were executed, were exiled. You don't need a better example than the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe's father, who was exiled and tortured and literally died in the prime of life, of Gaon Adir, because of what the communist system did to him. So Lubavitch paid a heavy price. Nevertheless, there always was a Lubavitch presence in Russia. There always were Hasidim there. The only people who remained Shomer Shabbos, and this is an absolute fact, there was one family in Leningrad, for instance, that remained Shomer Shabbos during World War II and the communists, the Fradkin family. And the Fradkin family, I have to tell you, were a Chabad family. And you had in every city a little remnant, and that remnant was Chabad, and the Rebbe told them not to leave, the Rebbe told them not to yell, not to shout, shtadlanut, we have to work quietly, we have to work through the channels. And that was the Lubavitcher approach. Those who were agudistim also followed that approach, and particularly there were one or two people who had contacts with the Soviet Union. Probably the greatest example was Rav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, who had grown up and knew the communists and had experienced communism before he came to America. And he felt he knew how to work with them, he knew how to deal with them, and he would be allowed in occasionally, and he published the Siddur with a new Russian translation, and it was distributed in some of the synagogues in Russia. So they felt very strongly shtadlanut. Over the years, the demonstrations began. Meir Kahana, as you know, got involved with more than demonstrating. Meir Kahana got involved actually fighting, shooting, incendiary bombs. Ultimately, a woman was killed, a Jewish woman, I believe her name was Irene Konis, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and she was killed. She worked as a secretary for Sal Yurak. Sal Yurak was a promoter, he was Jewish, he brought Russian actors, he brought the Bolshoi, He brought Russian entertainment to America, and the Kahachniks attacked him. Kahana was in Israel at the time. He claimed that he was not responsible for it, but it doesn't matter. His thinking led to it. Nevertheless, there were demonstrations, some of them small, bigger, and even bigger. Suddenly, by the mid-1980s, the communist system is arresting Jews wholesale, one refusnik, one prisoner of Zion after another. It was not the lull before the storm, but the storm before the lull. And now Gorbachev takes over, born and bred in the Ukraine. No one knew who this man was. I remember Russians telling me that in the Ukraine, you take in anti-Semitism when your mother nurses you. From your mother's bosom, you become an anti-Semite. It's indigenous to the Ukraine. And that's what people said about Gorbachev. And Gorbachev evidently discovered that the communist system is going to fall apart. What happened in Chernobyl, the explosion, the atomic meltdown, and suddenly it's the Potemkin's village, and he understood if he doesn't open up the system, it will disappear. Communism cannot thrive. People do not work. People want to be paid. When a street cleaner and a skilled medical doctor both get the same 100 kopecks a month, whether they work or don't work, for 100 rubles, I should say, whether they work or don't work, no one is going to work. And things were beginning to happen. Prisoners of Zion were being released. Prisoners of Zion were being brought back to Moscow and being sent out of Siberia. Gentile people who fought for human rights, Sakharov, the greatest example, suddenly is out of exile. No one understood what was happening. No one knew, will it last? No one knew, will this be a sea change? The year is 1987. By now, Russian Jewry is the one main topic on the agenda throughout the world. Every Jew who thinks, every Jew has a Jewish heart, every Jew is involved. Every kid in Israel, in America, in Canada, in Australia, in Great Britain, every Jewish kid in France, Russian Jewry, I am my brother's keeper. By now, the American Jewish Committee has a new head, a young man at the time, David Harris. And Sharansky has gotten out. Mendelovich has gotten out. And everyone is telling David Harris, we have to do something. And Sharansky says, we have to make a demonstration in Washington where 100,000 Jews will show up and yell and shout. Why did they want to do the demonstration at that time? It's right at the end of December on a Sunday, 1987, because Gorbachev is coming to America to meet with Reagan. And they want, number one, Gorbachev to know that the Jews will not be silent. They want Reagan to know that we want you to do your best. Refusal has to end. Every Jew should have a right to leave. Every Jew should have a right to get out of the communist country if he wishes. Freedom of travel. The time has come. Everything that has gone on in the past is over. And now the Russian government is in trouble. Chernobyl, money, wheat. They need America. Ronald Reagan, who was a friend of the Jews, do what you have to do for us and do it properly. Now, David Harris has a real problem. Sharansky is telling him what to do. The prisoners of Zion, Mendelovich, telling him what to do. Those that tried to hijack the plane in Leningrad 1970, they're all basically in Israel today. They're telling him what to do. But Gorbachev has opened up. And he's really caught in a dilemma. Can this demonstration work? In other words, what are we demonstrating for? The Jews might say, no, forget it. The Jews are starting to get out. Prisoners of Zion are coming home. And maybe this will continue. But he was worried. What will happen? How will this demonstration work out? Will people be excited? And I quote to you from the book I just mentioned. And by the way, I want to thank my Talmud, Rabbi Reuven Unger of Shalavim. Any of you know him? Any of you Shalavim boys? I want to thank Rabbi Unger for making the book available to me. He constantly feeds me books that he feels will be of interest. I'm quoting from page 523. While he was planning for the Washington rally, David Harris had the thought, ironic though it was, that his job would be much easier if things were worse for Soviet Jewry. He still faced the challenge of fashioning an appropriate theme for the rally. A consensus, however, soon emerged, almost universally accepted, even by the activists, that the gathering should not be a protest, but rather a way of offering encouragement to Reagan and reminding Gorbachev that they were still there watching. The rally would be positive, celebratory, a show of unity, bringing together the entire community and the many elements that made up the movement, and it means the movement to save Soviet Jewry. Now, I have to tell you, we never had a more successful rally of the Jewish people. Over 250,000 proud Jews descended upon Washington that Sunday. Maybe it was because Sharansky himself traveled from city to city for weeks trying to drum up participation. And his presence was persuasive. Thousands of rabbis pleaded with their congregations to go. Little girls saved up their babysitting money. Jewish groups from as far away as Anchorage, Alaska, chartered planes. And the response was unbelievable. In New York City, there was not a bus available for rental that Saturday night, that Sunday morning. Thousands of buses, hundreds upon hundreds, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, jumbo jets filled with Jews, three massive jets from Chicago, Houston, Palm Beach, wherever there were Jews, 250,000 people showed up. I need not tell you the speeches were endless, but fabulous. Eli Wiesel, who represents the Holocaust, I need not tell you, he spoke, I quote, "Too many of us were sold then. We are not solid today." Then a group of refuseniks spoke. All the prominent activists, people who had only been known as names and depressed faces on posters, were there. And it was stirring to see them all, some with large foreheads on their heads, standing on a stage together. Sharansky, Nudel, Begun, Slepak, Mendelovich. I don't want to go further, I just can't read it, but it was unbelievable. And it ended off with all these people on the stage in front of 250,000 Jews linking hands and singing the Hatikva. You may wonder what it means, all these refuseniks linking hands. See, what you don't realize, we Jews are a bright people. Whatever the reasons are, research has been done. All right, it could be it's inborn. It could be those who are not bright leave the Jewish people. You can figure it out. Some of you go into research. If you're not going to be Malamdim Rabbanim, figure it out. Fine. There's one problem with being bright, and I've lived all my life among geniuses. All my life I've been privileged to rub shoulders with geniuses. One problem with being bright: bright people think they know it all. It's very hard for bright people to compromise, to interact. I'm not a bright person, but one thing I can tell you, I took Musa seriously. So I don't have, those of you who know me know I don't have these problems. I told the OU when they started negotiating with me for those for the 9 hours on the Rabbi Religious Zionism, I said, look, I'm not a prima donna. I'll record it. Whatever you do with it is fine with me. When I got involved with the Washington Avenue, I told Rabbi Student, I know you've met many people, and I know you know my son-in-law very well. I said, I'm very different. I will never argue. Whatever you do, when after I give you the manuscript, is fine with me, quote, end quote. But bright, I'm not a bright person, but bright people, what are you, an idiot? I have 170 IQ. You're going to tell me what to do? I have a PhD, I have this, I published this book, that book, and refuse Nikim. Were the brightest people. You have no idea how capable these people were. When I met Elia Essas, I was blown away. Perfect Russian native language, Hebrew, Yiddish, French. I think he also knew Spanish. Anything he learned, he remembered, a photographic memory. So you're talking here, bright people, each one having their own ideas. For Slepak, Ida Newdell, Yosef Atzadik Mendelovich, Nathan Sharansky, who changed his name to Sharon, but it didn't catch on. No one knows my name is Rothkopf. People have gone to Dr. Rothkopf, and my brother will say to them, what are you doing, kids? There's a true story. A guy from the a Talmud in the Kollel says, oh, I study in Gris Kollel. He says, oh, do you know my brother? He says, oh, there's no Rothkopf teaching in the Kollel. Rakefet caught on. Sharansky never caught on. He changed his name to Sharon, but the name Sharansky, Natan, caught on. Very few people know his first name is Anatoly. Very few people know that. Natan Sharansky. For them to lock hands and to sing Hatikva together is miraculous. Please understand me. No, Morty is wondering, Charlie is wondering, Mayan Shmita Reitzel Hasina, Rebbe, well, it's all right, it's very nice. Excuse me. What does this have to do with Vahashem Zu Halacha? Gentlemen, this very rally goes into responsa literature with the finest tshuva ever written. Should you demonstrate or shouldn't you demonstrate? And I quote to you, Shela tu tshuvat b'nei banim, chelik sheni, by Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin. Now, Siman Nun Aleph. I repeat, Shela tu tshuvat b'nei banim, by Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, Chelik Sheni, Siman Nun Aleph. Again, I told you who Rav Henkin is, should live and be well. I think Morty mentioned to me after class, I should mention that his wife, Hannah Henkin, is a Stern College graduate. So although Rav Henkin himself never went to Flatbush and then to Columbia, studied with his grandfather. I have the greatest respect for him. He's a great Talmud Chacham. He's an original thinker, and halavai, we would have more like him. Now, he was asked, this tshuva is entitled Hafganat Leman Yehudei Rusia. The tshuva was written exactly at the end of 1987. And here, when all this is happening and all this is being prepared, and all this is being planned, and all the pressure is on, come and demonstrate, Rav Henkin gives a shayur. He evidently was visiting America. Acharei ha-shayurim etzlechem, you came over to me, and you asked me, should I participate in the big demonstration in Washington? And you asked me this very question. And I want to tell you that we have to look at the Makarot. And of course, the Makar for demonstrating is exactly the Gemara I quoted to you from Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yutet, Amid Aleph, where the Gemara tells this unbelievable story under the Romans, that the Romans made a Gezeira Kamalchot, Shelo Yasku B'Torah, Shelo Yamulu Et B'neihem, Sheyichalelu Shabbatot. What did Yehuda ben Shammua and his friends do? They went and consorted, took an Eitzah with a Matrinuta. By the way, I checked the word out, because if you recall, Rabbi Rubin had a whole theory that I don't want to repeat, and I can tell you his theory is wrong. Whenever Chazal used the word Matrinuta, it means an important woman, a matriarch. That's what the word means. Matrinuta is matriarch. It's not what you think. You're being misled by the English language, by the story of Nebuchadnezzar, another Jewish woman, Polly Adler. You understand? So, of course, they use the matriarch. They give her a coverage. I don't want to spell out who Polly Adler was. If you don't know, you're not missing anything. Take my word for it.
They didn't accept my definition of the matter.
They called it a madam, but matriarch, Matrinusa is not a madam. It's a matriarch. It's an intelligent woman. And they went to this Matrinuta, and Shekol Gadolei Roma Yimitzim Etzlah. She was a very intelligent woman. It's like a Nechama Leibovich. When Nechama Leibovich, you fellas don't know what you're missing. Nechama Leibovich, I brought her into the Kollel. I have a big skut. And we taught for many years together in the Kollel. In my book, I tell a story in Washington. You have a beautiful story of Nechama and myself where we're teaching classroom to classroom what happens after class. Anyway, when Nechama was teaching the Kollel, she was totally surrounded by people constantly asking her questions, bothering her. She couldn't walk Dalet Amot without being accosted in Yerushalayim by people who wanted. That's advice, insight, a pshat, an answer, a source. That's a matriarch. You have today Tamima Rothschild Mizrahi. No, you never see her walking alone. She's like her Rebbe. People surround her. You have the late Batsheva Kanyevsky, Zichronet Tzadeket Levracha. Who are we talking about? These are great women. So this gentle woman was a great woman that all the leaders of not only the Jews but the Romans constantly consulted with her. And they went and said, look what the Romans are doing to us, what should we do? And she gave them advice, go and demonstrate at night. And when you demonstrate, the theme should be yelling to the Roman leaders, Lo achechem anachnu, lo b'nei avachar anachnu, lo b'nei emachat anachnu. Aren't we all one? Aren't we human beings? Manish tanenu mikoluma, that you treat us so harshly. And okay, now here he alludes to what this young man said to him. See, and here you come to Das Torah, here you come to the so-called right-wing world, here you come to a world which I personally consider so distant from Torah Hashem, it frightens me at times. And at a certain point I'll tell you stories that happened to me individually that I just shiver and shake. What they do to young children who you want to turn into B'nai Torah, and they turn them into zombies. And this kid was told, Chas v'chalila, all demonstrations are ushered by the Torah. There's no such thing as a demonstration. You use shtadlanut. That's what the kid was told. So Rav Henkin says to the kid, you see from this Gemara, ein lahashkiach. Don't pay any attention to anyone who tells you all demonstrations are forbidden by the Torah. There is no such thing. Here is a demonstration right here before your eyes. However, he says, we have to understand, is this demonstration that you're talking about that's going to take place in Washington, is it like the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah? And you see that from the Gemara that you're allowed to get advice. And sometimes you're allowed to get advice even from Gentiles. And he says, whenever the Gemara uses the word matriarch, matinuta, we always know it refers to a Gentile. And all you need here is advice from the experts on the Soviet Union. They can be Jews, they can be Gentiles. Being Jewish now has nothing to do with it. You need a professor, Columbia U, International Relations, a professor at U of P, professor at Yeshiva University. Get a few people and ask them, will demonstrations help? And of course, in 1987, the Soviet Union was shaking. The walls were crumbling. Chernobyl was the Makaba Patish of what Lenin began. No question. Every Soviet expert would have told you this. Now, what do you mean a demonstration? What does a demonstration mean? Look at the way Rav Henkin analyzes the Gemara. When you learned the Gemara, little son, you went through it. He takes every word. Where does she tell them to demonstrate? Go to the Roman area. Go to where they live. Go to where the Gentile bosses are and demonstrate there so they know you are yelling, you are crying, you are making a case for freedom. Go to Washington, D.C. Go and demonstrate in front of the Capitol, in front of the White House, on that tremendous lawn. There is no greater representation of what America is about than those few blocks in Washington, D.C. Go to the Shchunat HaRamaim. Don't demonstrate in Borough Park. Don't demonstrate in Flatbush. Don't demonstrate on Pico Boulevard adjacent to Beverly Hills. Don't demonstrate where the Jews are. Go and demonstrate and yell and shout that every non-Jew in the world will hear your message. Free the Jews. Let my people go. Okay? It's unbelievable. Now, why at night? Why at night? Because at night, people are open to a message. And he brings down a number of pshatim here. Very fascinating. By day, people are busy. People are running around. I once gave a drasha, pardon me for this analogy, but you're going to go into the rabbinate, you got to deal with balabatim. So I once gave a drasha in Maplewood, South Orange. You all know I commuted from YU to Maplewood, South Orange. The 107 bus, I don't know, it's 50 years ago. I was there from 62 to 69. So I don't know if that bus still exists today. But I would take the subway down to Port Authority and take a bus to New Jersey. So one time I had to go someplace in Manhattan, and then I'm now walking to get the bus back home to New Jersey. And you know, when Manhattan is in motion, everyone is running, and there's innumerable stuff. And I said, and it's amazing. And then I see everyone's looking into a store window. Everyone is stopped. And I take a look at the store window. I looked, and then I turned away. It was burlesque. I don't want to describe what I saw. Everyone had time. That was my sermon, that if I would have tried to stop someone and say, I want to tell you about Yiddishkeit, I want to tell you about Torah, I want to tell you about Kashrut, Shabbat, and Tarot Mishpacha, Rabbi, are you crazy? We have no time. We have to make a living. We're rushing. We're running. Oh, but for naked women, they have time to stop, to look. I believe they've cleaned up the area today, 42nd Street, that whole area. I believe they've cleaned it up. I hope I'm right. Gentlemen, demonstrate at night. At night, people have time. These exact words. He brings the Aruch, he brings Pshatim. By day, people are busy. People are running. That's one part of it. Of course, the second part. Nighttime is a night of fear. You fear. Night not like day. The Rav constantly spoke about this. The day you have confidence, at night you don't have confidence. People can understand depression. People can understand despair. People can understand illness at night. Nighttime is a makam mimamakim karaticha Hashem. Demonstrate at night. And I told you more than once, I don't know until today what the Rav did. It's just unbelievable. I get caught up with this every Saturday night. I daven for the, at my house we have a minyan, sorry, Shabbos, we have a minyan in the parking lot. And we have a big crowd, and a block away is another minyan in a parking lot, and all the shuls are crowded, but Baruch Hashem, it's Yerushalayim Mir HaKodesh. So, Atah Kodesh. I said this morning, I always finish the davening in my shul for Mashrei. I don't daven anything before that because they would kill me. I daven too slowly. But for Mashrei, they tolerate it. Baruch Hashem. So with Velet Zion, you say Kedusha aloud. V'karazel zer. Don't you say V'shamacharai kol rash gadol. Didn't we speak about it yesterday? Didn't I speak about it here? Was it yesterday? Yeah, I think so. Anyway, V'chvav Hashem min chamol. What about Saturday night? Do you say it aloud? I heard the Rav with my own ears. I told you this so many times. Where the Rav thundered. Mitzvus nicht manach. Nighttime is a time of pachad. How can you say kadosh, kadosh, kadosh? And I think that Heschel writes that in later years the Rav changed his mind. But I still have a lot of difficulty saying it aloud at night, because at night, pachad, fear. Despair. Demonstrate. Then he analyzes the lashon of what they're saying. What is their plea? Why are we different? Why do you persecute us? Why do you torture us? Why do you find fault with us? Aren't we your brothers? Aren't we human beings? Democracy. You see, an enlightened person, the Romans were enlightened. The Romans were the leading civilization of the world. The Romans were like Washington, D.C. today. Rome, Washington. Democracy. What were they saying? They were appealing to their sense of justice, of equity, of righteousness. We're not making any special plea. We don't want special rules. We don't want special regulations. We don't want tax exemptions. Let us live our life. Every different person, every different religion has its own values. Let us be Jews. That's the way to demonstrate. And now he says, let's see your demonstration for Soviet Jewry. Is it like the demonstration in the Gemara? And he now goes back and takes the Gemara word by word and applies it to Soviet Jewry. What have they done? The Soviets. Shabbat, Brit Mila, Lima Torah. All yeshivot were closed down in 1917. Gradually, every last shul was closed. They allowed one shul to function in every city under the aegis of the KGB. No, if you don't have yeshivat, you don't have shuls. How do you have Talmud Torah? If you don't have Talmud Torah, you don't have Moalim. No one can be trained to be a Moal. You don't have Shabbat. And here he makes a very interesting analogy. He says, 70 years ago in America, we had no Shabbat either. Everyone had to work 5.5 days. In Russia, you work 6 days. No Shabbat. That's the law. That's the way the country functions. No different than America used to be. And I can tell you, Eidit Nemana, when I was a little kid going to Yeshiva Salanta, and I started learning Gemara, and Gemara is difficult. I write about this in the Rav. I quote the Rav. I don't have to quote Rakefet. If I can quote the Rav, I'm on much firmer ground than quoting Rakefet. Gemara is difficult. Michael Weitzman grew up speaking English, not speaking Aramaic, not speaking Hebrew. And suddenly at the age of whatever, I started Gemara at the age of 9, perhaps. 9 years old. It's difficult. I had no father to help me. My father couldn't help me. My father could barely read Hebrew. Father grew born and bred in Harlem and grew up on, by the way, my father also, all his formative years were on Washington Avenue, a few blocks down from where I lived. He grew up on 174th in Washington. I grew up 180th in Washington. We moved a little uptown. Father couldn't help me. So there was a man, Mr. Gabriel Weinstein, lived in the other side of the building. It was a big apartment building, 180th in Washington. He used to go to work on Shabbos, come home from work, have lunch, open a Gemara, and he would be learning Gemara all Shabbos afternoon. And I would go over to Mr. Weinstein, and I would ask him to help me with the Gemara. Unbelievable. And that was America. And Rav Henkin is Melamed Zchut Aleihem. By the way, you should know the Chafetz Chaim was also Melamed Zchut on the Jews in America. If you didn't work Shabbos, you all know the story. Don't come back Monday if you're not coming in Saturday. It's Pikuach Nefesh, perhaps. I'm not. Those that were Shomer Shabbos in America deserve the greatest credit in the world. My grandfather Mitzad, my father, I write about it, was never Mechalel Shabbos. It's unbelievable. And he, Taka, didn't know how to learn. And my grandfather, who had learned on the Lashon, if he went to Shul, Shoshana Yom Kippur, I'm doing okay. My mother's father. And he says, the Russian, what's happening to Russian Jewry is exactly what happened in Rome. What happened in Rome? No Shabbat, no Talmud Torah, no Brit Milah. No, we live with that until today. How many Britot had been done in Israel on men who are 40 and 50 and 60 and 70 and 80? I just read about some Jew who had a Brit Miller in his 70s. His kids all became Balei Tshuva here. Wow. What an analogy. What a mind. And then he goes on that the demonstration, what's the purpose? Everyone should hear about it. Let the Romans know you go into the Roman part of the city, you go into the non-Jewish part of the city, you yell, you shout, you want all the important people to hear about it. He says today, when we do a public demonstration, the Kli Tikshoret, the press, the radio, the TV, picks it up immediately. And everyone across the entire world knows about this demonstration, including in Soviet Russia, as far away as it is, but there is instant communication. And if this is the case, we have to demonstrate, we have to follow the advice of that intelligent non-Jewish woman. We have to demonstrate, listen to his words, in a positive fashion and not be negative and stress that which is positive, that which will attract the decency of the human community. And he says, to say that demonstrations are forbidden is absolutely untrue. And he says, Gedoli Israel, who want to talk about this topic and listen very carefully to these words, can only speak about this topic after they conferred with experts in this field, like Rabbi Yehuda Ben Shamua and his friends did in consulting with the matriarch. Wow. Wow. Now this kid who asked the question, he's been exposed to Das Torah. So the kid evidently told him that the Agudas HaRabbanim, Agudat Yisrael, he doesn't give the name, but one of the, it says, rabbinic organization. So I'll learn Pshat Agudas HaRabbanim, Union of Orthodox Rabbis. Read about them in the Silver Era. Gentlemen, they stated publicly that Reb Moshe Feinstein forbade taking part in the demonstration. On the other hand, the kid said, I know your question. I'll come to it in a second. On the other hand, the kid said that they say Hagon Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik Shlita was in favor of demonstrations. What is correct? Now, obviously, he doesn't mean that Rav Moshe spoke about this demonstration, because in 1987 Rav Moshe was dead. Rav Moshe died in 1986. But he means, I know exactly what it means, that the Agudas HaRabbanim said, quoting Rav Moshe, because Rav Moshe was the posek, and until today he remains the most famous posek that ever walked the streets of the United States. That Rav Moshe, the Rav already in 1987, was not functioning either. But they're talking about the past. And this is what the kid spoke about. And Rav Henkin says so beautifully that it doesn't matter what went on in the past. It may very well be that Rav Moshe said you can't demonstrate, and the Rav said you can demonstrate. But times change. Hazmanim mishtanim. The situation changes. Ein somchim al ma shamru lifnei yeser shanim. Because so much can change. And you have to consult with the experts and know what the reality is at this moment in time. And this kid evidently told Rabbi Henkin, I asked Rav Moshe in 1981, can I demonstrate at one of the earlier demonstrations? And Rav Moshe told me, I do not asa to demonstrate. And Rav Henkin writes, I spoke about this with Rav Moshe's son-in-law, Rav Moshe David Tendler. And Rav Moshe David Tendler said, if my father-in-law were alive today and knew what was happening in the Soviet Union and all the changes and all the different circumstances, my father-in-law would encourage the demonstration and certainly not asa the demonstration. Wow. And the kid also says he went to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky told him, years ago I was opposed to demonstrations because I knew the Soviet Union. I lived under the communists. I knew the cruelty they were capable of. But times have changed, and therefore today I cannot say it is Arsa. And finally he quotes his own grandfather. And this is very important, historically absolutely correct. Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin opposed the creation of the State of Israel. After the state was created, he became one of the greatest advocates, one of the greatest supporters of the State of Israel. So they asked him, my high, and all this is written, there are no secrets about this, because he was a prolific writer, he was head of the Ezra's Torah, he constantly had to deal with these questions, halacha l'maisa, and they asked him, my high, what is the difference? And he said, before the state was created, I was very worried that much Jewish blood will be shed, that chas v'chalila, there will be endless milchama, there was the War of Independence, there were seven Arab nations that attacked Israel in 1948. He was worried so many Jews would be killed. Once the state was created, if you oppose it, then many Jews will be killed. Because you're opposing the state. The state has to be strengthened. The state has to protect the Jews. The state now has a 50,000 Jews, 100,000 Jews, 500,000 Jews. In Rav Yosef Yelohyankin's lifetime, he lived to see the state with over 2 million Jews. He died in the 1970s, the mid-70s, and he changed his mind. The situation changed. And he writes very sharply at the end. He writes, people, let me quote him, ubiemet hagadolim yodim nishanot etaitom aval haktanim ein lehem dat v'einem yodim lishanot v'tolim atzman b'dat gedolim b'zman u'memakom she'achalolu lo dibru v'haday kinkulim movin mizeh. And truer words were never spoken. Great people know how to change their minds. It's not you changing your mind. Circumstances have changed. But foolish people, little people, robots, people who don't have a mind, they can't change their mind. They're brainwashed. Have you ever tried to talk to a Messianic Chabadnik? I've tried to speak to some of them. It's a waste of time. Don't waste your brain. They're robots. They're brainwashed. They have a look. They stare ahead. You can't reach them. Their eyes are frozen. Powerful words. What a tshuva. Daniel, you got 36 grand to put up to the IOU list? Willing? Baruch Hashem. Trust the Rebbe. One of the most embarrassing moments in my life, and I didn't write about it in Washington. I always tell my students, I always tell people who consult with me from all over the world, when you're writing Torah history, you have to write the truth. But you don't have to tell everything. You have to use a little seichel, what can be told and what can't be told. Not everything has to be revealed. History is an art. You have to be honest. You have to be truthful. But history is an art. As you all know, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky was put into Cheshirim many times over for telling the truth. I didn't write this because I just love Torah too much and I just don't want to embarrass the history of Torah. ברוך אתה אדוני מלך העולם שהכל נהיה בדברו. אמן. By the mid-80s, Russian Jewry had not only captivated every thinking Jew walking the face of the earth, but it even broke into Haredi circles. I have a little bit of a role in that. I was privileged with my wife. We got the Esas family out of Russia. Probably we gave him 18 months to 2 years on his life. Of course, he would have gotten out by 87, 88 for sure. But he got out Tu B'Shvat 1986. Esas is coming out and the high publicity and the interviews on the TV, the radio, the Haredi press. Suddenly the Haredi world woke up that there are Jews in Russia with long beards. Jews who learn Torah, teach Torah. Jews who are Shomer Shabbos. And Esas had a big impact on this community, on the Haredi, so-called Haredi community. And if there's one Esas, there are 100. And if there are 100, there are 1,000. And then there's potential to have tens of thousands. Right after our second trip to Russia, it has to be about 86, 85, 86, probably end of 85, our handler, the man who I revere, Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, Aryeh, after we finish our usual business, this is in the compound, in the most closely guarded building at that time in Tel Aviv, was this nerve center of Soviet Jewry, with a tremendous computer that had the name of every refusenik that they knew of. And there was, you have no idea the security. It was much more security than the Central Army Base, than the Mate Klali, which was two blocks away. And after we finish our business of who's going and who's sending and the reports from the Shin Bet, can this one go, can that one go? I says, I have something very big for you. We had a meeting and with the higher ups, with the, I don't want to mention all the names, but Cheskel of Onan, who ran it and was set, only reported to the Prime Minister. We want you to be our representative and you have to use Seichel. And I said, what are you talking about? He said that Rafal Halperin approached us. Anyone recognize the name Rafal Halperin from the Haredi world? Very interesting individual. Wrestler, world fan. When I was a kid, he used to come to the United States and wrestle with the mug and David on his trunks. Big Talmud Chacham, published Sfarim, entrepreneur. At that time, he owned beautiful restaurants in Rehov Dizengoff. It's before he opened up this chain of optical stores, etc. Rafal Halperin approached us. They want to do a big demonstration in Bnei Brak. We're going to give him your phone number. He's going to call you. You meet with him and give him our rules. And among our rules, by the way, this comes out in the book as well, but among the guidelines set by the Mossad people, the Nativ, we never criticize the communist system. Our goal is not to break down communism. Our goal is not to bring in capitalism. Our goal is not to tell them American democracy is the greatest. Our goal is just to get the Jews out, repatriation, let them rejoin their family. Explain that to Rafael Halperin. Explain to him how we work, explain to him our message, explain to him how we demonstrate, explain to him what we want to stress, and we will make a budget available. This would be fabulous to have very important rabbanim. It'll create tremendous pressure on the Soviet Union in the sense that all of Israel is yelling and shouting, and it will create tremendous pressure on America, our goodest rabbanim, our goodest Israel, that they too will be involved. All right? I meet with Rafal Halperin. He takes me out to lunch in one of his beautiful restaurants. I'm wined and dined, and we hit it off. We become friendly, and I break him in. I teach him, and I tell him, and I talk with him. And a few weeks go by, and Aryeh says to me, I don't repeat his words. And Aryeh, you have to know, was a Bnei Akivanik, a kid who came here as a teenager. Bnei Akiva, one of the founders of Kibbutz Sad, which is right in the line of fire today, right adjacent to Aza, Gush Katif, and Aryeh Kroll, he exploded. What happened? You won't believe your ears. This is 1986. The Soviet Union is shaking. The walls have fissures in them. They heard, the Gedolim heard that Rafal Halperin, you know, we can't do anything without permission from the Bnei Brak, the Litvisher Rabbanim, who are his Gedolim, and they contact Rav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz. And Rav Teitz, who already was an old man, I believe it was his last trip to Israel, 1986, comes to Israel, yelling, shouting, banging on the table, Chas v'chalila to demonstrate, Chas v'chalila to make noise, Shtag lanet, like 1938, don't make the mistake of demonstrating against Hitler, which only got him more angry. If you demonstrate against the Soviet Union today, you will only get them more angry. And the whole Haredi press is quoting Rav Teitz, the Gadol Hadar, the great expert on Soviet Jewry, etc., etc. Gentlemen, to say I was embarrassed is an understatement. I had to look people in the eyes, in the Mossad. These are world famous, important people in their field, in their dedication, in their contributions, in their insights, in their intelligence, people were hitting their heads against the wall, and this is Torah, this is a great rabbi, and this is someone we should respect, and this is someone we should look up to. The Dapiyim were jumping off the roof, let alone the Chiloniyah. What a mistake. And there's nothing you can do. It's Das Torah. And I love Rav Tides. Maybe he was right in 1966 with that approach. I doubt if he was right in 1976. But I can assure you, he was 100% absolutely, totally, completely wrong with that approach in 1986. And history, looking up, quoting the Rav, quoting the Chamesh Drashot, boy, did God ring out loud and clear. God bless the Jewish people. What is it saying? The Ribbono Shel Olam's tefillin, Mika Amcha Yisrael, Goy Echad Ba'aretz. What you accomplished, what you did with yelling and shouting and demonstrating, you let my people go. The overwhelming majority wound up coming in Aliyah. There are reasons why, things that happened in the late 80s and the 90s, and among them, so much tshuva, so much greatness. And it's just, people look, well, 10,000 Jews are Balei Tshuva. What about the other 50,000 who are Mechallel Shabbos and don't know a thing about Yiddishkeit? But you don't realize there's statistics at work. People become Balei Tshuva, they marry. They don't just have one child and a dog. They have families. And suddenly the children marry. And they're already totally integrated on the Israeli scene. Many of them in the Haredi world. Even more in the Chadali world. And before you know it, because one person was Chozer B'Tshuva in 1990, by the year 2050, he has 200 direct descendants, Be'ezrat Hashem, Rubam Labriyut Kukulam, Shomrei Torah U'Mitzvah. U'mikam Chayisrael, Goy Echad Ba'aretz. It was a very embarrassing moment for me. Crow didn't let me live it down because, you know, it's hard for me. I love Gedolei Yisrael. I admire Gedolei Yisrael. I understand what they've done. And Ein L'dayin Ein L'mashein of Ro'at, V'yiftach B'doro, K'shmul B'doro. And with it all, it's so hard even to try to explain how Rav Tites could say this. And the whole Haredi press picked it up. Torah Misinai, Das Torah. One more source today. Powerful Gemara, powerful tshuva, Rav Henkin. If you see him, tell him a yashikaya. He's had problems in life. He never found the right niche where he could teach, where he could have an outlet. It's very important for a person. Okay, he's the posek for his wife, the posek for a major institution, the posek for so many institutions like that today. And let him know that we appreciate that tshuva on Russian Jewry immensely. Ah, now let me show you a Gemara. The second Nida, Daf Chavet Amid Bet. That's exactly bringing Rav Henkin to life. Gentlemen, one of the most difficult issues a rabbi has to deal with is Marot Dam. Today we have women trained to deal with it. We debate, do you depend upon women? And I don't know what the debate is all about, because the Gemara says openly the Safra law, a woman has total ne'emunut when it comes to Hilchot Nida. Nevertheless, many Rabbanim still get Sheilot. Blood, what color? A woman has a discharge. It's not a perfect red. Is it dam nida or isn't it? Okay, and it's not an easy matter. You have to have shimush. And I'm told that Rav Tinla has a chart of various colors of blood, and he can show you which blood is nida and which blood is not. According to the Gemara, of course, red and black are the colors of nida. Black is supposedly some form of red. Yellow or green or other colors are not them neither. Fine. Tell me, what about if a woman has a discharge from her body, which is not in liquid form? It's a gush. How would you say that in English? Let's see the translation. Let's see how we translate. I'm forgetting my English. Runes. Yeah, I'm looking at Schottenstein. A lesion of rins with kinds of red hair. I don't know. It doesn't sound too good to me. I'd rather stick to the words of the Gemara. It's not exactly blood. It's something more solid. No. Is it blood? Isn't it blood? Does it make her an Idah or doesn't it make her an Idah? Amar Rav Elazar Rav Tzadok, Shnei Ma'asim Hela Abba Mitivon Liyavna. When Rabbeinu Tzadok, the great Rabbi Tzadok, who fasted before Kubin Yerushalayim, you know the Gemara in Zikin and Gittin, when he came from Tivon to Yavna, he had two stories that he told them, the Chachamim, about. Masa b'yishu yatama pelet kamin klipot adumot. And a woman was, not blood, but klipot. Why would you say klipot in English? Peels, rinds, of blood, of something that looked red, that looked like blood. And she came and asked my father, and my father asked the Chachamim. No one knew what to answer. Is it blood or isn't it blood? No. What are the next words of the Gemara? V'chachamim sha'alu l'rofin. The sages asked the medical doctors. V'yomru lahem. Shazu makha yeshla mitoch meyecha. Shemimena mapelet kaminklipot. And this great doctors told her she has a makah, a lesion, a wound in her womb. And as a result, she spits out klipot. Wow. V'shuv ma'aseh b'isha sh'aytam ha'pelet k'minsel rapa dumot u'ba'ah v'shalat abba v'ah v'shal l'chachamim v'chachamim l'rofim v'yamru lechem shuma yesh la b'toch meyaha sh'mimena ma'pelet k'minsel adumot. Very fascinating. Two stories. Sages didn't know what to answer. Is it blood? Isn't it blood? His father, Rabbeinu Tzadok, a Gaon, a Tzadik, a Tana, went and asked the sages. No one had an answer. The sages went and asked the doctors. And the implication is that these doctors were not Jewish, but they were experts. And the doctors gave them the answer. And of course, here once again you see exactly what Rav Henkin had to say. You have to consult the experts. The experts can be like the Matinuta. They don't have to be Jewish. Remember that series of ads in the 1960s that won every award for advertising? Who remembers what I'm talking about? You can see a picture of it in the Encyclopedia Judaica. You don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's. And boy, did that ad catch on in every subway car. One week they showed an Arab eating rye bread. One week they showed an Indian eating rye bread. One week they showed a big Afro-American who could have very well been Jewish, but they didn't realize it, eating rye bread. And week after week, you don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's. You don't have to be Jewish to be an expert. And what a powerful Gemara. Now, I don't want to go into more detail on the Gemara, because I would have to give a whole shiur now. There's an interesting line that comes afterwards that they experimented with the rind or with their hands, threw them into water, wanted to see if it turned into blood. And there's a whole machlokes rishonim. What does it mean they experimented? They experimented to prove that the doctors were right, or they experimented to check on the doctors? And you understand the difference? If they experimented to check on the doctors, it shows you they didn't surrender totally to medical opinion. They had to check. If they were just following the doctor's advice that the doctor said to them, throw it into water, and you see it's not blood, then it means they totally believed the doctors. And there's a whole literature about this Gemara. But once again, I want to show you the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the great Aruch HaShulchan. Look into Hilchot Nida, Siman Kuf Pei Chet, Sif Samech Hei. And after he describes this whole machloket, this whole Gemara, and he says, Umidnei, I'm quoting from Sif Samech Hei, 65, Umidnei Shebeinyan Ze Talui Ikar Gadol B'Sheilat Nashim, In Mutalis Mochal Arafim, In love, the yesh osrim, the yesh materim, ulani vetati barua leketer. Gentlemen, the Aruch HaShulchan paskens, black and white, when it comes to questions where the rabbis have limited knowledge, where you have to consult with experts, whether it's political science experts, whether it's statistical experts, whether it's scientific experts, whether it's medical experts, you can depend upon those with whom you consult, even if they're not Jewish, 100%. Psak of the Aruch HaShulchan. And that psak reverberates and has unbelievable application and inferences. So I repeat, Baruch Hashem, I don't know, I found my name here, Rabbi Rakefet. What is this, from a Purim play? Or it's to remind me what my name is, Baruch Hashem. Either way, I'm happy about it. Rav Rakefet, excuse me, okay. I never write Rav, I always write Rabbi. The reason is I don't want to give out grace. These people, they have Rabbi, Rav, Maran, this, that, Rabbi. We're all rabbis. We're not all rabbis. It doesn't matter. But at least I don't have to give out grades and get into trouble. Gentlemen, today's shiur was about one topic. The 1987 demonstration in Washington, D.C. We never had such a massive demonstration. It was an unbelievable Kiddush Hashem. That she'elah that Rav Henkin was asked has been asked endless times. And as I told you, I was sitting right next to the Rav when the Rav was asked already in the 50s about Kahana, and the Rav said, what, we shouldn't demonstrate? Bad, the terrible mistake we made in 1938. Adarava, we have to yell, we have to shout. So of course that created a reputation that the Rav was in favor of demonstrations. I know that in later years, someone asked the Rav, his own relative, should he go demonstrate? And the Rav told him, told to me by the person involved himself, the Rav said two things to him. Go and demonstrate, but don't get involved with those Kahanamics and with the black hats. I don't know what, you know, I think it was a Russian demonstration, but the Rav warned him about two elements not to get involved with. So he later said he didn't get involved with the Kahanamics, but unfortunately he wears a black hat. He didn't listen to his grandfather on the black hat topic. So it's fascinating. But Ein Achinami, Reb Moshe Feinstein was probably influenced by Reb Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, and there probably was a period where the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Reb Pinchas Mordechai Teitz probably had wisdom to their point of view, that there was more to be lost by demonstrating than to be gained. But there's no question by the 1970s, the demonstrations were crucial, and the KGB taunted Sharansky in jail, who is demonstrating for you? Housewives and school children. And as Sharansky wrote in Fear No Evil, that those housewives and school children got me out of the hell of the KGB and Russia. So that Sha'ilah and the way Rav Henkin approaches it and analyzes it is classic. And I have to say, the Gemara Nida just fits in with that approach like a glove on a hand. And of course, the Orech HaShulchan, who we know was so down to earth and his feet were so firmly on the ground, he is literally axiomatic that absolutely you have to listen to the doctors 100%. And he takes apart the sugya. I don't want to go into it because it would involve an hour and a half of the shiur. But he takes apart the sugya and nida and shows you that everyone agrees you have to listen to the doctors. That is not the machlokes with why they threw the wind into the water. Gentlemen, the best is yet to come. Because next week we deal with the Rav, we deal with the Chaim, we deal with the heart of what is the problem with Das Torah. With the Sunday class, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up exactly where we left off. I saw yesterday that the contradictions in the Rambam are exciting. I saw the intensity by which you were listening. It's exciting. It's fascinating. How do you paskin? What do you do? I'll show you some very fascinating material next Sunday. Be'ezrat Hanotein le'ya'uf koach. Now, I just want to say, I got more material sent to me on the Mechitza B'peh, and I just want to suggest if the Rosh Yeshiva in YU would listen to me, we should all get together and issue a psak, not just Rabbi Moshe David Tendler. Rabbi Tendler was put into cherem by the Haredi world for coming out against Metzitza B'peh years ago. I just saw in a Haredi newspaper here where they write about Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. It was his yard site, Purim time. It's the 30th, what is it, 1986. It's what yard site? Figure out yourself. It's the 25th yard site, am I correct? 26th yard site? So they were right by Rav Moshe Feinstein. He has only one son-in-law, Rav Moshe Chaim Shiskal. They don't mention Rav Moshe David Tendler. Take a look in Tashavu in the magazine section on the little thing about Rav Moshe. They don't mention him. All his son-in-law were Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe Shiskal, Rav Moshe Tendler. In that family, if your name is not Rav Moshe, you can't get into the Feinstein family. So all the Rosh Yeshivas should come out. Peh echad, that is, that mitzitza b'peh is absolutely forbidden. And that way no one will feel bad when they don't do it. It's not a question of frumkeit, it's a question of pikuach nefesh. Mi yotcheh gadol mei Reb Chaim Briska, mei Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, mi mori Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi. Now, a Rabbi Zev Farber wrote a whole article here, Mitzitza B'peh, Protecting Jewish Infants. He is from Atlanta. Does the little son know Rabbi Zev Farber? Do me a favor, ask your father who it is. It's a good article, but I only worry that he's a graduate of Chovevei Torah. Why should they get the credit? Why can't we do something proper and l'shem shemayim? Also, I mentioned this yesterday. I was walking with the Talmud, and I saw someone in Machon Lev with an Israeli flag. This is a picture my grandson took in Auschwitz when he went. This is a Sfada kid, a Dota Mizrach, wearing an Israeli flag in the death camp, and he falls to the ground crying. He's so overwhelmed. If anyone wants a copy of this picture, they're welcome to it. And here's a picture my grandson took. I don't have to tell you what this is. Abed Macht Frei. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das verdanya. Thank you very, very much.